I got a real lawyer next to me. It's Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney. Mike, how are you, my friend?
Great to be here, John. How are you?
You've had a busy week, haven't you?
It's been an interesting week. It was 3 days in a row of sentencing hearings in federal court of all different types of cases. So it was very interesting week. Kind of fun aspect of how the job can vary day by day, I'd say.
Are those lighter weeks for you? Because you just kind of sit back and, I mean, obviously you're working on other cases, but at some point, you just are like, well, I've already done my arguments, and I just wait and see what the judge says this week.
I would say no, because there's a lot of prep that goes into the sentencing hearing, which we could talk about if you want. But once you get to the sentencing hearing, you're still dealing with a lot of client issues and emotion going in, right? And also client preparation in terms of what they're going to say and how they're going to say it to the judge. And then also your own preparation, because even though you've put this all on paper, you're going to go in and argue legal issues before the judge, and then you're going to get a decent block of time to argue about what you think is appropriate sentence. So you're definitely not just sitting back and saying, hey, let's hear what the judge has to say.
Do you argue that and get the ruling on the same day, or do the sentences come down some time after you've already made your sentencing arguments?
Almost universally the same day. In Chicago and federal court, always what happens is the sentencing hearing could take anywhere from a half hour on the low side to a full day to more than a day. Typically, it's a couple of hours, or could be an hour, hour and a half. But then normally the judge will just then pronounce the sentence, or sometimes they'll take a break and come back and pronounce the sentence. But typically, yeah, you know that day exactly what's going to happen. That's why there's a lot of client anxiety that goes into that, and client management, and of course your own anxiety.
I imagine so. 312-981-7200 is our phone number, and Tim's on the line and actually wants to ask you a question about probably the sentence that most people were familiar with that made headlines. Hey, Tim, thanks for joining us.
Hi there. Sorry, I am in my car, so...
You're fine, Mike.
Okay, okay.
All right, so...
I've been following this Heather Mack case, and I was just wondering how you could argue that the sentence that she was given was too harsh, knowing that she, the heinous crime. I did read up and saw your interviews on TV, and I was surprised at how I thought she might get more years. So I guess I'm just wondering how you justified that.
It's a great question, Tim, and this is something I asked Mike about too many times, is you're obviously representing a client that has pled guilty, Mike, to doing some heinous things. So what's your response to what Tim says? And I think what a lot of people say when they see a defense lawyer, whether it's you or someone else, saying, no, come on, this was too harsh.
Sure, and that's not exactly what I said, John, but...
Okay,
But in any case, there's a lot that goes into the judge's decision as to terms of what the sentence is going to be. And in every case, almost universally, there's going to be mitigation or substantial mitigation. That may mean the age of the offender at the time they did the offense. It might mean their circumstances and background, abuse, neglect, any sort of factor along those lines, lack of role models, harsh living conditions. The fact that you've served a sentence somewhere else, essentially for the same crime under horrendous conditions, those are all what we would call just examples of mitigation, right? And so in the Mack case, you kind of start with the concept that it was charged as a conspiracy. That offense has up to potentially a life sentence. However, if you look at federal conspiracy cases involving murder, no one's justifying murder or excusing it. Typically, the sentences that are given, if you look at the statistics, are usually in the 30 to 40 year range. That's kind of the norm if you look at all those cases and all those sentences. Sometimes substantially lower, sometimes higher. In this case, the prosecution acknowledging the fact that she had served a 10-year sentence and had served 7 years of that in another country under horrendous conditions and some other factors, agreed that a life sentence or something approaching that was not appropriate. So you had the buy-in from the government and the prosecutors that, hey, even we don't agree that a life sentence is appropriate.
And I want to just make that clear, because some people will say, well, she should be going for life. The prosecutors themselves, the government, the state said, or the government, federal government said, we don't want that either.
Correct. So there was a plea agreement in this case. The maximum sentence under the plea agreement that she could get was 28 years. The government, federal prosecutors agreed that that would be appropriate. it left open the question of, okay, so it's a capped at 20 year. That's the most a judge could give. So the 28. Right. So the judge was tasked with the decision of, okay, considering all the mitigation and all the circumstances, everything involved with this offense, and this person, more importantly, and this person's background and history, what do I think is the most appropriate sentence? So what made the hearing extremely interesting was not only the extensive, you know, pretrial submissions that we put in writing before the hearing, but probably some of the most intense and emotional testimony, you know, from victims and also people that supported her, that knew her mother well and knew the life that she led before this offense occurred when she was 18 years old. So on the one hand, you had victims who spoke obviously very passionately and extensively,
understandably,
about what a great mother she was to Heather and all those sorts of things you'd expect, and that was very emotional. You also had people who spoke on Heather's behalf who told an extremely different story, and you had people including someone from Heather's father's side of the family. He's deceased, but from his side of the family, given their perspective on what that household was like. You also had the counselor who counseled Heather and her mother for a long period of time, addressing the court really for the first time, kind of a really an intense drama about what that relationship was. So that was one factor
right.
in mitigation.
All, and this is not all to paint a picture of justification. It's more to paint a picture of what the reality you say was.
Correct. You know, of course, from the prosecution standpoint, they wanted to and did portray the defendant in the worst possible light that they could. And part of it's their job, right? And they focused on the nature of the crime because, of course, it's a horrific crime. And that's what you're going to do. But they also focused extensively on what a fantastic life Miss Mack had growing up and all those sorts of factors, which that narrative turned out to be really not true as a fuller picture emerged. And again, it doesn't justify the killing. It's not a defense to the killing, but it's what's called mitigation. Because every judge is going to look at the defendant before them and try to figure out, okay, how did this person get to the point in their life and their development that they would do something like that, right? And as you and I talked about on the air, one of the emerging lines of cases in federal court is looking at the adult brain versus the juvenile brain, right? Really up to about age 25, and case law saying, hey, look, at the neuroscience tells us we have to take a serious look at other factors. And why did juvenile offenders, someone really up into their 20s, why do they make decisions from a neuroscience standpoint, right?
Right.
So going into kind of getting back to Tim's question, I think we're answering it, but we had agreement that a cap of 28 years was appropriate. Then the judge, after hearing all the written submissions, hearing from all these people, taking into account the time she already spent for the exact same crime, under what conditions she spent her time, her relationship with her daughter, all those other factors, he had to decide, okay, am I going to come off that cap? What sentence am I going to give her? And he ultimately, taking all those things into account, said, okay, I think the appropriate sentence is 26 years.
Taking 2 years off.
Yeah. Some people would say that's far too much. A lot of people like Tim would say that's far too little. And that's what, you know, that's the great thing about our system. We can argue about it all day long. And judges like this one, who are extremely experienced, great judges, can make these hard decisions.
Tim, I wanted to ask you kind of a follow-up. Mike, you want to put your headphones on. Having heard all that reasoning, Tim, what do you think? Would you be able, if you were that judge, to take in those mitigating factors and bring a sentence down like that? Or what are your overall thoughts?
Well, I guess it tells me I probably didn't. I don't know all the mitigating factors.
Right.
You brought up some things that I had not heard. I just, as a, you know, just having read all of the description of the crime
right.
and the planning that went into it, I guess I was just,
For sure. And I'm not calling you out, Tim,
because I should have been more.
I have this internal thing, too. And Mike and I have talked on air about this. This, you know, you have respected defense attorneys who that is their job to make these defenses. And it's just a delicate balance. It's hard, Tim, right? These are hard decisions. I'm glad I'm not the one ultimately making them, Tim. Thanks for listening.
Is she able to get parole at some point? Is she going to serve the full 26 years, do you think?
For good behavior,
sort of,
what do you think?
Well, that's a great question. So really, here's how it works in federal court. You get your number, which is in this case 26 years. You minus off that immediately the time you've been in detention awaiting trial or awaiting sentencing. So in her case, she's been in federal custody for about 3 years. So you get credit for that, which makes sense because you're in custody. You're in federal custody.
Right.
So 26 minus that three. And then in federal court, you generally serve about 85% of your sentence. So you're going to multiply the 23 by 85%. That's going to take you down to about 19 and a half. And then the reality is, especially because of some changes in the Bureau of Prisons and the way we look at long sentences, that you're going to get some credit while you serve your time, assuming that you participate in things that you need to participate in and get good time credit, so to speak. So you can expect, if you have a sentence like that, you're probably going to get a couple more years off. So the number is much less than it would look at first glance, but it's also taking into account time that you've actually already served in federal custody already. So the number will be lower, and it could be significantly lower. But the judge knows that, and he's taking that all into account as well.
Right. Tim, we appreciate your thoughts and calls, okay?
Thank you.
Yeah, for sure.
Thank you.
17 years. I mean, I don't want you to reveal behind the curtain anything that that is obviously personal information, but obviously those are emotional moments, and she's 28 years old, and 17 years, some people might say that's nothing, and maybe they have a point. That's a long time to a 28-year-old.
Well, it's a long time for anybody. I mean, I personally have a very difficult time being overnight in custody,
right,
in a 4x8. But, you know, it's how you look at it. And we have vastly different perspectives across all sorts of society and about, you know, the sentencing process and how much time people get and whether it really is serving a legitimate aim of sentencing. And, you know, empirically, we found out over the years that, you know, the longer sentences don't necessarily serve the legitimate aims of sentencing. They don't provide any greater deterrence to that defendant. They don't provide any greater deterrence to members of society. So there's been a real look at, you know, what are we doing with super long sentences. But we get, in a case like this, when the offense conduct results in a murder, you're going to understand that people are going to have strong feelings about how much time should be served.
And so it's all done then, essentially, right? I mean, you'll have follow-ups, or there's no appeals process at this point, right?
Well, in this case, there's not an appeal process. That was part of the plea agreement, so there won't be an appeal because you can't have one. Most cases, after sentencing, you've either, of course, gone to trial and been found guilty, or you have pled guilty and therefore been found guilty. And typically, you can appeal, and if you've just had a case where you've just been pled guilty and sentenced, it's very difficult to come up with reasons why your sentence should be changed. You'd have to really show in federal court that the judge just didn't consider something he should have, or he or she should have, or considered something he shouldn't have, he or she shouldn't have. So those are tough. But if you go to trial in federal court, just like anywhere else, a lot of things happen. There's a lot of legal issues that are ruled upon, not only before the trial, but during the trial. And you might have a lot of reasons that you can appeal. This particular case doesn't include that, because the plea agreement foreclosed an appeal.
All right. Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney, 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Going to talk about the suspension, or the ending of the suspension, for the Illinois basketball player after this on WGN. Mike Leonard's a federal defense attorney. He joins us on this program. We might have a lot of new listeners today, Mike, on a Sunday.
We could, John. We could have thousands and thousands of new people joining us, especially if they hear from us today, John.
And you're a federal defense attorney. You represent a lot of people. You also represent whistleblowers, too. You like to fight the man.
I do, including you, John, because sometimes you're the man in this studio, at least.
For sure. This is going to take longer than just this segment, this case, but can you give us the background for the Illinois basketball player Terrence Shannon Jr. and a really stunning decision by a district court judge to allow him to play basketball in light of some pretty serious charges?
Yeah, it's a great intersection of civil law, criminal law, sports, and John, if we could add pizza, I would be in heaven.
Okay.
Because those are things I love, right?
All right. So what's going on here?
We'll eliminate the pizza.
Right.
So, interestingly enough, it starts with the player on U of I's basketball team, who's a top talent, was projected to be a pretty high draft pick, probably a first-round pick, and the Illini are having a very good basketball season. But in September, he went with some friends down to the Illinois-Kansas football game down in Lawrence, Kansas. And so an incident occurred. He wasn't immediately charged with a crime. U of I was notified that there was an investigation in the fall of 2023, although no charges had been filed. Ultimately, in December, in the county in which Lawrence, Kansas is in, they indicted him one felony count. I believe it's either rape or sexual assault, but it's a sex crime felony, and then also a misdemeanor charge. So then U of I got notice of those
very serious charges.
I mean, obviously, a felony charge of any kind is serious. Sex crime is very serious. Of course, would carry, you know, prison time if you were convicted, but we're not anywhere near that. But U of I got notice of the charge, and therefore, within a pretty short period of time, suspended him from the basketball team.
Which seems very normal and what teams do all the time.
Correct, yeah, and you see that a lot. I mean, when there's a serious charge, whether you're innocent or guilty, it doesn't matter. A lot of universities will suspend a player. So at that point in time, he and his counsel were left with the fact that they're not going to be able to do anything in Kansas to affect his eligibility to play.
Right, because the case is not going to happen for a while.
And that case isn't going to go to trial. If it does go to trial, let's assume it does go to trial, it's probably going to be, who knows, it might be 2024, might be 2025. So what they did was they made a play in civil court. They filed a case in federal court down in the Central District of Illinois, which encompasses, you know, the Champaign campus, that federal court jurisdiction. And they did what we've talked about on your show before. They went for a temporary restraining order and also seeking a preliminary and then permanent injunction, right? They're trying to get the court on an expedited basis to give a temporary restraining order to say, U of I, you can't do that, right?
Mm-hmm. You can't suspend your players because of that they don't have the right to do so, or that they didn't follow their own rules.
They didn't. The argument was they didn't follow their own rules. They denied him due process. So when you file a civil case, when you're trying to get a restraining order, you still have to have legal causes of action, right? So you might have a cause of action that says breach of contract. One might be violation of your due process rights, et cetera, et cetera. But the key to a TRO case is you're trying to get the judge to say, okay, hold on. Until this case is decided, we're going to enjoin U of I from doing what they did. We're going to put the parties back in the condition or status they were before Illinois suspended them. So they argued that Illinois had not followed its own processes and therefore denied him due process. And also they made other arguments that it was a violation of his scholarship contract and other things like that.
And I want to dive into the specifics of this. And the end result is he's playing right now as Illinois is playing against Rutgers.
Yeah, so what happened is judge...
Hold on, let's get to it after the news.
See
what we're doing, Mike?
Okay.
When I put my hand up like this...
Wow.
That means, yeah, right, sorry.
I'm learning, John.
He's playing right now. We'll dive into exactly how that's able to be when he's facing a felony in Kansas. But we'll do that after the news here on WGN. And one of the big legal cases... just the last couple days, has been a federal judge on Friday reinstating the Illinois basketball star Terrence Shannon Jr. If you're just joining us, Mike kind of gave the TikTok of what's been happening in this case, but he is alleged, well, he did go with friends to watch Illinois football play in Kansas in the fall. There was, then he was later charged. There had been an investigation. He was charged essentially with rape in Kansas. The University of Illinois suspended him from the basketball team. He then went to court with his lawyers to the Central U.S. District Court, where a judge says, hello, Illinois, you cannot suspend this player. He must be allowed to play. What was the reasoning the judge gave, Mike?
Sure. There's like three factors that go into whether you're going to grant injunctive relief, meaning if you're going to immediately stop someone from doing something and put the parties back in the position they were.
Mm-hmm.
So, number one, the judge would look at, okay, he has legal claims against the university. Does he have a likelihood of winning those claims when the lawsuit's ultimately decided, right?
So the judge can kind of almost like read the crystal ball of the rulings. Or like, are they just seeing like on its face, is this ridiculous
correct,
or not?
It's called likelihood of success on the merits, meaning it's you're not prejudging and saying you win, but do you have, you know, substantial, significant legal claims that you could prevail on, right?
And we're not talking about prevailing on the rape charge. We're talking about prevailing against the university.
No, meaning that Shannon and his attorneys had, not only did they ask for injunctive relief, but they actually have to also file a lawsuit. So count one might be breach of contract. Count two might be violation of my due process rights, et cetera, right? So the judge is kind of just taking a quick look and deciding, okay, those claims that you're asserting that someday will get decided either by me or by a jury, do you have a reasonable likelihood of succeeding on those claims? Or really, you know, if they're frivolous, then no. You know, I'm not going to grant the TRO because you have frivolous legal claims, right?
And the claim is that the Illinois University of Illinois did not follow their own procedures in-house
Correct.
For suspending someone.
Yeah, violating their own processes and violating, in broader sense, due process, right? So the other factor the judge had considered is, will this basketball player, will he be what's called irreparably harmed? Meaning if I don't act, will he suffer damage that can't be cured by the lawsuit, right? You and I have talked about this before, gave the example of someone going to court and say, hey, they're trying to knock down my building. I want you to enjoin them from doing that, because if you don't, the building will be gone, right?
Right.
The third factor the judge had to consider, or should have considered, was, again, this is getting legalistic, so it sounds like jargon, but does he have an adequate remedy at law? And so what that means in a lot of cases is if you can recover money ultimately down the road in your lawsuit, then typically they're not going to enjoin the other party because they're saying, well, it doesn't matter. You know, your remedy is money. And if the case goes forward, if I don't enjoin U of I, eventually you'll get that money if you win your case. So in this case, you know, the judge, it was an interesting decision because you're getting into sports law stuff,
mm-hmm.
which is good. And the NIL stuff, John. So if your listeners don't know about NIL, in college athletics now, these guys can cut these deals for what's called name, image, and likeness. So you have players, football players, basketball players, sometimes getting $1 million or much more than $1 million to go to a school and to then be able to promote their name, their jersey number, their likeness, etc. So the judge in this case indicated that this U of I player has a significant NIL deal. That deal might be diminished. He's also a top NBA prospect, and his and is noted by the decision. His draft stock in the NBA draft has already dropped, so he's suffering damages as we're going.
So the judge is showing
the
basketball player is losing money or potential money in the future
Correct.
By sitting on the bench.
Correct. However, U of I and a lot of people would say, okay, I agree with you, Judge. He is losing money. He might lose this NIL deal. His draft stock might go down. We all agree with that. And it's already happening as we're speaking. But a lot of people would argue, well, sure, but that's something that can be solved by money at the end of the case,
meaning,
right?
Terrence, in this lawsuit, the basketball star, he could in the future sue the University of Illinois for damages, meaning like, you didn't follow your own process when you suspended me. It cost me $12 million in NIL and potential MBA earnings. You're going to give me that money back. Since that process in a hypothetical could play out that way,
yeah.
Often judges say, well, yes, you are losing money. That's potential. But guess what? You can figure that out down the road.
Correct, because you still have that remedy of getting your money somewhere down the road as the lawsuit plays itself out. So, but
she didn't do that.
She talked about his diminishing NBA draft potential, his potential loss in his NIL deal, but ultimately concluded that he had made the appropriate showing to get an injunction entered, and therefore U of I put him back in the court because the judge said that since they didn't follow the processes, he needs to be reinstated. However, Illinois can still now go through those processes and give him due process, follow their own rules and regulations, and suspend him if they want to do that. Some cynics out there, John, of course not me, might say that maybe U of I like that result because now they can say, hey, it's the court's fault, and this guy can play, and maybe we can go to the Final Four. Some cynics would argue that, John, of course not me.
Did you dive into the details or take a look at what Illinois' policies are for suspending a player from the team? Because it seems so strange to me that a university, including my alma mater, wouldn't have it laid out pretty clearly on how that process works and then follow that process to a T.
Well, yeah, I mean, I do know in general because I did read the judge's opinion. It's pretty lengthy, and it goes through all the processes that U of I has in place. Number one, there is an argument about what processes even apply, right? Whether it's Title IX, which is a federal law governing universities, whether it's the university's own internal policies and procedures. So there were a lot of arguments about that. But in general, the argument that prevailed from the judge's standpoint is that, gee, you know, you were given kind of a modicum of due process at the beginning, but you really didn't follow all your processes before suspending him because all you really allowed him to do was to submit a statement. You didn't really conduct a legitimate investigation. You didn't give him a chance to legitimately be heard, all that kind of stuff. So the judge said, okay, therefore he can't be suspended. So Illinois could now go through all those processes and decide he could be suspended. The problem and the benefit to the player now is that those that would take longer than the season. The season would be over before they got through that.
Well, then I just am left wondering, why does a university not have a policy, and maybe I know my own answer to this question, but why isn't the policy for major universities, if you are charged with a felony, you are suspended until that is remedied?
Well, in general, that's consistent with U of I's policy, but there's more to it. All schools have, therefore, what has to happen. It's not usually just that occurs and then you're suspended. There's usually some other processes that occur, and U of I did have in writing policies and procedures that would give him more than just that. So every university has policies about these subjects. Clearly, most universities have felony as a basis for imposition of all these policies and procedures, but they usually give them some due process. Now, it's not just, okay, you're charged, you're done. It's usually more than that.
Man, this is a complicated one. And it's interesting that it involves the NIL stuff. And I think that just one more example of when laws are written, and NIL basically coming from a U.S. Supreme Court unanimous decision that these players are eligible for this stuff, that there's a lot of ramifications down the line that comes from those sorts of things.
Yeah, real interesting case. So, you know, I'm a Iowa graduate, so I'm always rooting against U of I anyways, John.
That's a good time to take a break. More Let's Get Legal powered by the Illinois State Bar Association after this on WGN. Mike, the Madigan trial you wanted to talk about. This has been delayed, which is, I guess, no surprise, right? But this one has an interesting wrinkle to it. So this is about former Illinois State Speaker Mike Madigan. Of course, years and years in this alleged bribery with ComEd and all this sort of stuff. Tell us a little bit about it and what's going on next.
Yeah, not too much to report, but the latest update we should probably cover is just the fact that the trial got pushed back about 6 months. Of course, trials do get moved. In this case, it's a little more, there's a particular reason is that there's a case that's going up to the United States Supreme Court,
right,
which may have a significant impact on the Madigan case because, you know, some of the counts in the Madigan case in federal court in Chicago deal with the federal bribery statute, also known as 666, because that's the statute's number, right? It's not because there's any ghosts or murders.
Yeah.
So one of the big issues, there's a split amongst the federal appeals courts about the breadth of that statute and how broadly it should be interpreted. And the argument being made by Madigan, not by Madigan, but by the case that's going to the United States Supreme Court, is that courts have been taking way too broad of a view of that statute. And therefore, when something happens like legislation gets passed or an act is done by an official, and later on someone gives them something of value, a gratuity, right, a gift, even if the politician didn't ask for it as a basis to pass the law or do that official act, a lot of federal courts say that's still bribery. And a lot of people say, how could that be? From the defense side, how can it be that you're liable for bribery when you didn't ask, you know, it's not a quid pro quo. You didn't say, hey, give me $5,000 and I'll pass that act. It's you did something and someone comes along later and says, hey, I'm going to give you this or I'm going to give you that. Clearly in recognition of the fact that you did that, but they didn't ask for it. So the U.S. Supreme Court's going to have to weigh in and decide what that means. I think they'll probably decide it in a way that's favorable to Madigan. His case isn't being appealed. Mm-hmm. Another case that just will affect his case, right?
All right, I just want to make sure I understand. There are conflicting views in appellate court right now about what exactly bribery means for officials or the breadth of which it can be applied, that you can't bribe officials. And this disparate ruling or different courts ruling different things is really tied up on the idea of a bribe that comes after the fact and that was unsolicited.
Yeah. And how do you call that a bribe? If someone says, hey, John Hansen, thanks for passing that legislation because I know you're going to run for office someday.
And since this impacts the Madigan trial, the court agrees, hey, let's just wait until the Supreme Court takes it up because we don't want to have to rewind and redo everything anyways.
Yeah, because you could try the Madigan case right now as scheduled. And then the U.S. Supreme Court comes down and issues an opinion which guts the indictment or gets rid of some of the counts. And a lot of the evidence that would have been presented to the jury is stuff that no longer should have been presented to the jury, right? And you have to do the whole trial over. So wisely, the judge, it's Judge Blakey in federal court in Chicago, said, let's stay the Madigan trial. We'll continue it for 6 months. If there's not a decision by the United States Supreme Court by that time, I would anticipate they would continue it again until they get that guidance. Otherwise, you're kind of running in the dark, and you might have to do the whole thing over anyways.
Well, we should have a result by the end of June. We're going to get a lot of results in the coming weeks about what's happening with the former president, with a lot of different legal cases all in the air. Some of them are civil cases. Some of them are criminal cases. We've talked ad nauseum about them, but they're important. I guess the latest updates, and it's been a quirky week for two reasons. The E. Jean Carroll case is this defamation case. She's already won one of those, right?
Correct.
Against former President Trump. She then, and I believe it was immediately after the case was settled and the former president was found liable for defamation against her and ordered to pay money, he then allegedly defamed her again, like that night on TV.
Yeah. He didn't. He certainly was not deterred by that first verdict.
No.
Yeah, so interestingly, the E. Jean Carroll case, the second trial, it's only on the question of damages, right? How much money she's entitled to receive for other acts of defamation that weren't covered by the first trial. So that case is pending in federal court in New York, the Southern District of New York, which is a very prominent court. And the jury is going to be tasked with just deciding what monetary damages she's entitled to recover for whatever the defamatory statements are in that case. And so that's the latest update. What makes that case interesting is that Trump has actually been attending. And what happened was...
Murmuring.
Yeah, while she was testifying, he was, you know, intentionally saying things really very loudly, you know, but pretending he was saying them to his lawyer so that the jury could hear what he was saying.
Like he was like leaning over and being like, witch hunt.
Yeah.
Said it loud enough for the jury to hear.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm not joking. That is what he said.
That's true. I know. So he was, you know, in any other court with any other defendant in history... No federal judge would ever tolerate that. Like if it was one of my clients, John, who wasn't a former president, they would be, after being admonished and yelled at by the judge, they would be tossed out of that room. But this judge is, so far, in my view, handling it wisely. Because, you know, Trump does probably want to draw himself being kicked out of the trial, so he can argue that's an unfair process. So this judge is being somewhat smart. He's basically saying, hey, no, you want me to kick you out. I'm not going to do it. But I'm going to do something more to you if you continue this your antics, right? So, again, going back to this concept of how people are treated under the law, I know a lot of your listeners have said in the past, oh, you know, since he's a former president, he's being treated worse, he's being picked on or whatever, he's being singled out. But in a lot of instances, including this, obviously he's being treated better by the court in a different manner, more favorable because of his status. It's a little surprising, too, because the federal court judge involved is very experienced, so it's surprising that he's sort of, in my view, putting up with this.
I believe the former president, I think everyone should kind of agree to a basic set of facts. The former president is entitled to defense in all of these cases.
Of course.
A robust defense, and some people think he's stalling and arguing immunity. That is his right to argue immunity.
Absolutely.
He's doing it, and the process should play out the way it should play out for everyone. I have strongly believed that. And I feel like it should play out the same way, though, for behavior in the court.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, you know, you're making a good point. You know, some people saying he's stalling. Another, because that's stalling. He filed a good motion that any lawyer would follow in his, file on his shoes, which is in the federal court case that involves the January 6th events, he filed a motion to dismiss the case, to dismiss the indictment, saying, I have immunity. Because I took those acts while I was president, I'm immune from prosecution because of those. Now, you might not like the legal argument, or you might like it a lot, but it's a wise move, and if you have any chance of winning, you're going to file that.
It's inbounds. It's
correct.
Within the rules of how this is supposed to play out.
It's a good play. Well, why wouldn't you try to get the case dismissed if you could, if you have any chance at all? But in that case, so the development in that case this week, which is in federal court in Washington, that judge, you know, as we know, she denied his motion on the immunity grounds. That case is now on appeal. He's probably going to lose that appeal. But the district court, who's overseeing the January 6th prosecution, has said, hey, look, we're going to essentially put things on hold. That March 2024 trial date probably is not going to happen. So that's making things very interesting. You know, what's the timing of the January 6th trial? Is it going to be after the election? Is it going to be before the election? That's going to be huge. And, of course, what's going to happen is the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals is going to issue their ruling and saying, Mr. Trump, you're either entitled to immunity, or more likely they're going to say you're not.
Three judges.
Then he's going to take it to the U.S. Supreme Court, which I don't imagine they could ever rule before the election.
You don't think so?
No.
I think the Supreme. No, I disagree. I disagree. I respect you, and you know everything about this, and I don't. But
can we
will
can
say,
we bet a slice of pizza and a beer?
Yes.
Okay.
More than that.
Can you, Radian, can you write that down? Yeah. There are a lot of bets that have been uncalled.
I think the Supreme Court is itching to get the immunity case to rule against him because they will rule in his favor for allowing him to be on ballots. And I think that they want both these cases, one, to show both sides that they are fair and impartial. I think it'll be a 9-0 decision in both cases, or close to it.
Wow, that's interesting.
That he should be on the ballot, or close. I don't think it'll be. I don't think both will be 6-3 ideological cases. I think the Supreme Court will rule. This immunity thing is really important to figure out before whether President Trump is back as president again, or to the future of the country, what President Biden is allowed to do or not while he's still in office.
Yeah, no, those are great points, John. I think though that. Let's say the case goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, which it will, on this immunity issue. I just don't know if they can, even if they rule before the election, that does mean the trial of the January 6th events is going to happen before the election.
That. I'm talking about the Supreme Court and the immunity alone.
Yeah. No, I think you might be right. I think they're going to agree with the government that he's not immune, right? Or
right.
Not complete immunity, certainly, right?
Right.
And then on whether he should be on the ballots or not in the various states, that's a great issue. And I think I agree with you. I think they'll probably find that he should be on those ballots, although there's this big state rights argument that why can't the states decide who gets on their ballots? But I think you're right. I think the Supreme Court's going to say he has to be on all those ballots.
I would agree. And I think that they'll do that. And I think that they'll show that they have basically a win and a loss for Trump. And I think they're itching to be able to do both those things because the Supreme Court right now, poll after poll shows it's losing its quote unquote legitimacy amongst the American voters and the American public. And I think they want to try to restore a little of that.
Good points, Mr. Hansen. You still need to enroll in law school, though.
Exactly. Because I don't really have any legitimate beefs. We got a minute left. Mike, obviously you're a defense attorney. We've talked about it. I know you had other sentencing cases this week. Really quickly, juggling three sentencing cases on three variety of topics. Busy week, fun week?
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, it was like sentencing week. So we had the Mack case. Then the next day we had something entirely different involved what's called white-collar fraud, right? So whether the defendant, my client, was charged with wire fraud, that case already went to trial. The question was, what was his sentence going to be? The government was arguing for 22 years to 27 years, which personally I thought was outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we were arguing for much lesser sentence, and I think
Shocker. Common
sense prevailed, and the judge gave him a 7.5-year sentence instead of 22 years, which we thought was a nice, nice win.
You?
Yeah, and then on day three, the next day, was something entirely different, where we're arguing a sentencing involving drug distribution and a gun. So each day was entirely different than the other, and it just kind of highlighted how fun the job can be
for sure
for doing different things.